This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 7th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 196, with me, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck.
On the show today, we'll meet Dror Morey, director of The Gatekeepers, an extraordinary documentary about Israel's security agency, Shin Bet, that's attracted praise and rage.
We'll step out of the margins of Japan's artistic community and speak to chief curator at the Wellcome Collection about their new exhibition, Suzu, Outsider Art from Japan.
And we'll meet David Goodhart, director of think tank Demos and author of a book, A British Dream, to discuss immigration and its effect on the white working class identity in Britain.
That's all coming up. Plus, Tom Edwards will be here with the week's coming news, and we'll be playing some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Episode 196, another day, another dollar. That's $196, Andrew. Split between us. What's that? Do the maths.
Not enough.
It's
That's
never
what
enough.
I say.
On the way down the stairs, as we printed our script out, came down the stairs, a lot of people said, you should change the playlist on Monocle 24 to put on the Christmas tunes again.
I know, it's snowing.
It's absolutely
it's
mental.
Been snowing this week. In fact, I saw one of our guests is sitting out in the green room with a Christmas jumper on. Well, almost Christmas jumper.
Almost an Alpine Christmas jumper. It looks quite good. Yes. I saw him as well. Yeah, I think that's what's required. We are still a furry hood of a shanker on head of snow boot.
It's kind of stopped being funny now.
I know, it's really stopped being funny. I know. There's a lot of messages bouncing around that are just like, grow up, stop it. Do you know what month it is? I know, it's one of those things where it starts in November, you kind of go, this is great, maybe we'll have a white Christmas. By the time there's snow resting on daffodils, everyone is a little bit kind of... It's a little bit passé.
Yeah, especially in London, this was our one week of summer last year. We got it in early, out of the way, and then we had a miserable wet summer. Anyway, that's nothing about the weather.
I had a barbecue to keep the snow off. It's the only way to do it. Anyway, we'll pull through it. It'll be fine. We've got some good guests lined up for this show. It's nice. It's got a serious edge to it. We should warn listeners, not warn listeners, but ask listeners to look forward to, maybe sit up a little more in their chair as their morning coffee this afternoon.
Slightly fewer jokes this week, maybe.
Yeah, but we'll do them at the end once the guests have gone.
Yeah, we'll all pack them in at the end.
That tends to be how it
and
works.
And we do have someone we like to tease coming in as well.
We do. Up next, we're going to have the man that perhaps is looking into a snow globe rather than a crystal ball this week, the one and only Tom Edwards.
Keeping you in the loop and on the ball, this is Tom Edwards with his weekly look ahead.
Tom, we introduced you before you walked into the studio saying, I wonder whether you're looking into a snow globe or a crystal ball. Which is it going to be?
Snow globe.
Okay, phew. There's no news in that. Phew, that gets that boring bit out of the way. What should we talk about instead?
Well, I want to start with something that's happening tomorrow. This is slightly macabre and, you know, sinister in some ways, but also interesting from a cultural viewpoint. It's something we touched upon at the end of last week, actually, on Monocle 24. They're digging up Pablo Neruda tomorrow.
Are they?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, supposedly... He died.
Supposedly he died.
Of prostate cancer.
Okay.
No, he definitely died.
Okay.
Supposedly of prostate cancer. But a number of people close to him, including his former driver, in recent years have alleged that he was actually poisoned shortly after. Because obviously Neruda was a celebrated sort of left-wing activist. That he was poisoned shortly after the coup that brought General Pinochet to power. And so they're going to exhume him, which is the word I probably should have used in the first place.
Not dig up.
Dig up, which is slightly... Slightly crassly put. And
test him out, see what's going on.
Test the things and see if there's any truth to it. Mm. It's slightly sinister,
but kind
of amazing.
There's been a lot of digging up, hasn't there? We had Arafat.
Again,
he was
allegations
up.
Of poisoning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bit of exhumation.
You're going to look to me for one, aren't you? I can't think of anyone that's been
And Rob, I see you've let the side down.
No, hold on. In Spain, there's been lots of exhumations first of people who were killed both in civil war. And weren't they going to Lorca? Wasn't he meant to be dug up?
He was.
Okay. I'm just thinking of Sleepy Hollow.
Were you just about to do a list then of dug-up people?
No, I was just doing a doodle to make it look like I was thinking of
someone. I think it's amazing on several levels. One is this whole thing about, you know, bygones. I guess you probably wouldn't feel that way if it was a member of your family and there were questions. But it is interesting that so often people seem to feel the need to do these things to sort of get... What's that dreadful
closure?
Do you know what I mean?
And
people want to see these things. And it's interesting how resonant it is. And also that there is the technology to be able to... How is this possible?
You need a spade. There's not much technology.
Okay, so you got a JCB, but then what do you even find in there? Just a little tiny skeleton. I don't know what you do.
A skeleton.
Well, that's... send your tiny skeleton if you're trying to decide what happened to the stickleback.
It's strange. It'll be slightly macabre, but
well,
also...
last week we had Peter Stanford on, who was talking about his book, Graveyards Around the World. And he pointed out that we won't be able to do this in the future because everyone's now cremated. It's very hard to kind of regather the ashes.
Yeah.
Although you can try.
It's always difficult to regain the ashes, isn't it?
Is a first-class sporting joke.
It is. Worthy of Andrew Tuck when we were talking about fascism in the Sunderland Football Club.
He was great. Andrew's not been banging on about that again.
Yeah, he has. He's been talking about it non-stop. Jack Phillips, by the way, just said down the line to us, our studio manager today, Richard III. I don't think he's doing Cockney rhyming slang. I think he's talking about exhuming. I don't think he's casting aspersions on the quality of our banter. I think he's
that is also excellent. I think, yeah, of course, Richard. And he was
he was under a car park.
And now they're fighting about where to rebury him.
So they dug him up. Now they're arguing about how to inhume him again.
Inhume him. Exactly.
Which I found out last week is a word. Kenya. Now we all remember we had the big presidential election, of course, last month, and the president should be sworn in on Tuesday. If all goes according to plan, he's now successfully sort of negotiated his way through various court appeals. This is Uhuru Kenyatta, of course. And I just think it's interesting that he'll be sworn in. There'll be great fanfare. It's obviously the usual vexed question about which foreign dignitaries will attend and who won't, and these kind of diplomatic wrangles. And one of his first tasks, of course, almost literally his first task, may be to then defend himself against these allegations at the International Criminal Court in The Hague of sort of various crimes against humanity linked to the previous election in Kenya. And I just think it'll be interesting to see from a kind of diplomatic viewpoint, people sort of wishing him all the best, and then off he'll pop to The Hague potentially.
Tough, isn't it?
Or whether, of course, this has kind of made something of a mockery. If he successfully returns to election, goes through the courts, it all goes off without any trouble, does it hamstring the ICC's efforts? Does it make them look ridiculous?
The bit I've missed about, is he actually going to go to The Hague?
Well, I am not 100% sure whether he's going to actually turn up, because I'm imagine
he's got his KLM ticket.
Legitimately, look, I need to get on with running my country. We've got, you know, serious problems close to home. But the fact is, it's not going to go away anywhere. And I suppose the worry from the International Criminal Court is whether this sort of turns international opinion against them. And they say, look, you know, you need to pick your battles more carefully, because somebody who's obviously capable of going through a democratic process, being endorsed by his people, going through the courts all very legitimately, is probably not the kind of villain you need to be chasing.
It's a sort of political and moral exhumation, that, isn't it?
I like that.
Have you got anything else you've dug up for us?
You guys are on. This is incredible. I feel like I'm on. It's like being interviewed by Morecambe and Wise. this is something at the end of the week on Saturday. This is something, Rob, I know you'll be interested in, because
bring me sunshine, Tom.
This is just getting better and better. Yeah. The Rijksmuseum, of course, actually opens on Saturday. Now, I know some people who shall remain nameless may have had some kind of behind the scenes. I don't know, but for your sort of man in the street, he can actually go along on Saturday, completely free of charge.
It's a wonderful place. I'd recommend everyone to go there.
For a day.
I'd heartily recommend it.
So it'll be Queen Beatrix. Her last official hurrahs before her abdication. Mm. And then everyone else can pile in after her and have a look around on the cheap.
Because we should say that it was the last issue of Monocle, wasn't it? A very fine piece. The current issue of Monocle.
Yeah.
And Rob Bound went there and he got the guided tour. You got in free as well.
Even ahead of Queen Beatrix?
Of Queen Beatrix.
How does that work?
I don't know. You
pushed her out of the way, didn't you?
Pushed her out of the way.
Finally, as a sort of theme for next week, which I feel I should flag up to our lucky listeners, we're sending our briefing programme on the road. Salone in Milan, of course, Monday through Wednesday. It doesn't stop there. Thursday and Friday, Madrid.
Whoa.
This is to Think Shower.
What?
Think Shower?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
This is a creative and cultural hub event that's taking place in Madrid.
Well, I'm going to that, but I didn't know it was called Think Shower.
Yeah.
I thought that when Liam Aldous, our correspondent there, said Think Shower, it meant wash before you come.
No, of course, as you well know, Andrew, zinc, as we would say it.
Oh, zinc.
But it's pronounced think, and that's where the punning comes from.
Oh, okay.
And there's going to be a lot of excitement. We're going to have some very high-profile interviewees, possibly even a world-renowned footballer.
I know that you and Rob Bound are laughing over the fact that I may have to ask a football question. And I think, actually, Liam Aldous is probably as rubbish on football as I am. But I'm going to prove you wrong. I'm going to do my research.
I'm glad to hear it.
And whatever happened to little Joe Cole? I used to like him.
This is absolutely I'm astonished.
I forgot why you were obsessed with little Joe Cole. Has Joe Cole retired? Does he play for West Ham? Does he go back to West Ham?
No.
Tom, thank you so much for leading us through what's coming up in Monocle next week. That's important. And all your digging in the dirt that you've done. Thank you very much indeed, as ever, for your news look ahead. Dror Morey is an Israeli filmmaker whose new documentary film, The Gatekeepers, tells the story of Shin Bet, his nation's internal security service. Its history unfolds through a series of cool interviews with six men who ran the organisation. As they sit and tell their stories, you hear about the decisions they made in often brutal detail. You glimpse the moments when the chances for peace in the Middle East slipped away, and you see men who fought for their nation but often seem troubled by where they have found themselves.
The film has won praise for the filmmaker, but some at the heart of the Israeli establishment believe that Morey has betrayed his country. He came to the studio to talk to me earlier.
Dror, thank you very much for coming to see us. A lot of territory to cover, I think, in this interview. Can we start with a very simple question for our audience? Can you just explain to us who Shin Bet are and their significance within modern Israel?
Shin Bet is the intelligence agency. Basically, in Israel, there are three intelligence agencies. The Mossad was responsible for outside of Israel. I would compare it to the CIA, the military intelligence, which does everything. And the Shin Bet, who is normally, or his main function is to cover the inside territories, inside Israel and the occupied territories. He's a kind of a combination between CIA and FBI. He is responsible for also the targeted assassination. Basically, it's an intel organization, very clandestine in the Israel. And it's a very, very important. The people who are working there are the specialists on, I would say, the war on terror and about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This is their main issue.
Now, the film goes to meet the people who have run this organization over the years. And it has an arc that goes back to 1967. And the film works in lots of different levels. So it's a history of the region and of contemporary Israel. But it's the story of these men who ran this organization. Can you explain to me how come, when you went and knocked on their doors, they agreed to tell their stories? Because they sit talking to camera. The story that unfolds is one that kind of terrifying, at times a story of bravery, at times a story of when their humanity slipped away from them. It's an incredible film to watch. How come they told you these stories?
Look, I think that the timing for me to approach them was really good for them, because they feel that for a long, long time the country, the Israel policy, especially the policymakers, are doing the wrong thing, and they're not putting their most efforts in trying to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And they feel that this is the most important issue that Israel should deal with. And I think that this is why the primary reason why they came to speak so openly and candidly. By the way, all of them, all the head of the Shin Bet, of the secret organization, came and spoke openly for the first time. Until 1995, we were not allowed, even the Israeli public were not allowed to know their names and the public figure. They were just called by their initials. Only after the assassination of Rabin, the only person from the Shin Bet who is allowed to be known is the head of the Shin Bet. And all of them came to this film because they felt urgency to tell their message, because they were there on the ground dealing with all those things that you talked about, maintaining the security of Israel, and they feel now that it didn't lead Israel into a better political reality.
Now, there's lots of things I want to quiz you on, but before we move on, can I just ask you, is there a sense that these are men all of a certain age, and they sit there looking, you know, something like your grandfather, and then they begin to tell these stories of events that they've been involved in? Do you think there's a little bit, just pulling the story away from the political to the personal, is there a little bit of these people looking back over their lives and thinking they've done lots of things to protect the state of Israel, but my God, you know, where have we ended up? And they kind of want some solution, some resolution for themselves maybe as well.
Well, some of them are younger, you know, some of them are 55. It varies from 55 to 85, because all of them came to speak. If there is something that I can say that they share in common, is they are pragmatists, they understand the limitation of power. And when they see Israel today, which they fought so hard in order to preserve, in order to maintain the security of the state of Israel, They understand that in all their efforts went in vain. They didn't bring Israel into a better place. On the contrary, they feel that the more Israel is moving on in the course of time, it's less and less safer. And the politician, basically those leaders, the head of the Shin Bet answer only to one person, the prime minister, should have done much more than they did.
I think that's one of the extraordinary things that comes out of this film, is that you would imagine that within the state of Israel, that the security services and the politicians, because they've all served in the army, they have a kind of shared history, a shared ambition, that their blood would flow through the same veins. But in fact, when these people from Shin Bet talk, you see they have a weariness of politicians and a feeling that in the end, the politician will always let you down. Was that something that you felt came across in the making of this film?
Yeah, if there is something that was shocking and riveting to me as an Israeli, because I'm a product of the educational system of Israel, where you were always taught that Israel is always striving for peace, that Israel always seeks for peace, and that the Israeli leaders always did their utmost in order to reach peace. And when you hear from those people, from the head of the Shin Bet, who work very, very closely to the prime ministers of Israel all through the years, when they say how much missed opportunities were there by the prime minister of Israel, not only by the Palestinians. By the way, the Palestinians have their share of guilt in the situation that we are in, but to understand that the Israeli prime minister, the leaders of Israel also didn't really want to move forward and really did it honestly. They spoke about peace, but didn't really had the courage to go into the methods, into the terms of that needs to move forward in order to reach peace. And this is something that is devastating for me as an Israeli, because I think that the most crucial problem of Israel is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It shares and sheds shadows all over the region. And Israel, it's in the best interest, and it's not me only, this is what the gatekeepers, the head of the Shin Bet, are saying, that this is in the best interest of Israel to reach two-state solution.
Now, I guess that two-state solution was almost there at the very beginning. Right at the beginning of the film, you see these people talking about the fact that, you know, they met the Palestinians, and it was very early on suggested that there could be a Palestinian state. And people within Shin Bet at the very beginning thought that this could be a good idea, this could be a solution. And in fact, in a kind of odd, old-fashioned way, when you see those people who were, as it were, the enemy, the Palestinians they were dealing with back then, they seem like farmers. They say it was a much easier time. There were so many opportunities that were lost back then. And then when you look at the kind of the jihadists and things at the end of the film, you realize that the situation today is so much more complex and so much more embedded. People on both sides, you know, so much less able to kind of look each other in the eye. Did you have a kind of sense of despair as you heard those stories and you looked at the lost opportunities and you got to the end of the film? When you finished the edit, did you think, oh my God, this is a difficult time?
Yeah. Look, I have to compliment you that you understand the film better than anybody else that I've encountered up until now. Really, this is, if there is something that I felt so grieflessly, is when you watch, look, I've watched, in order to make this film, I've watched around thousands and thousands of hours, really, literally thousands and hours of news clips from the beginning in 1967 until today. You see there literally how much easier it was in the beginning and how much it got complex, more complex and more complex as we moved through time. The more radical came as long the way which the problem was not solved, the more force was used in order to suppress the uprisings. And it created more and more animosity, more and more terror, which became much more violent. And I think this is one thing that relates to the previous question. If there is something that those people understand, the head of the Shin Bet, they have used force. This is what they did. This is what the security forces heads are doing. They are using force in order to suppress. And they understand at the end of the day that force cannot lead you to a better solution. Force can lead you to until a certain point, and beyond that point, you need great leaders in order to solve the problem and reach and bring to the people of the region a better political reality. And the problem is that never, ever, the political leaders, on both sides, by the way, the Palestinian, you know, Arafat had his share of guilt of what he did, but the Israelis are to blame as much, and that's the problem. And when I asked one of the heads of the Shin Bet what should be done, I mean, what do you think should be done? And he said, you know, the biggest problem of this conflict is that you need two great leaders simultaneously at the same time. And this is what makes it so difficult. Even If there were great leaders on both sides, it would be difficult. But to have those two great leaders on both sides at the same time, that's what makes this problem is so almost unsolvable. And if you ask me, I'm really bleak. I think that the film represents my point of view to the letter and also their point of view as well.
I think there are many extraordinary scenes in the film, and I do want to make it clear to everyone listening, this isn't a kind of a one-sided film. There are some moments that will stop you in your tracks when you're with a camera above a bus that's been bombed, and you don't pull away. You show exactly what carnage looks like, and you hear people talking about what it's like to smell flesh. So let's make it clear that this film very clearly paints the acts of terror that have happened on both sides of the divide. But there was
the film comes from the sixth head of the Israeli Secret Service. It's a film that speaks from the center of the defense establishment of Israel. To think that this kind of people will be one-sided, people that spent their life mission was to protect the state of Israel, to say that this film, it has to show both sides, it has to show. But this is what I think that what is singular in that film, that it comes from those people. It doesn't come from those, I would say, those bleeding heart leftists. It comes from the center of the defense establishment of Israel.
Now, any country or any society or any group of people who feels that they are under attack, there's a natural instinct for cohesion and for putting up barriers and for holding other people back. You've put a spotlight on things which may be public knowledge and may have been covered in the news in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, but which perhaps people don't really want to think about or contemplate now. At home in Israel, have people said to you, you shouldn't have made this film? I understand that the Prime Minister has made it very clear that he has no intention of watching your film. In some sense, are you seen as betraying a kind of narrative that people need to survive and get through their daily lives in a way?
First, the response to the film in Israel was amazing. And you can tell from the kind of response that we've got from where in the political arena this response came. Mostly, I would say center-right as well. Center-right, center-left endorsed the film completely. And they think that this is one of the most important film ever done in the history of Israel, definitely in the history of the conflict. So this is one side. The extreme right wing, of course, they have a lot of problem with the film and the message of the film, and they are putting the blame on me, basically saying it's the director who cherry-picked those people's thing and created the message through what he did. But up until now, and also when it was interviewed, the deputy prime minister was interviewed in a radio in Israel saying that the director is the one that is blamed for the message of the film. Immediately after that interview came one of the heads of the Shin Bet who was in the film and said, no, Mr. Deputy Prime Minister, this is what we all, six heads of Shin Bet, think. The director didn't twist anything of what we said, and you have to deal with the message.
Well, as Dror says, it's a film that has many tough lessons and many dark moments, but it's certainly a film that I would encourage everybody to watch. And the film is The Gatekeepers, and you should make sure you get to see it. Thank you very much for coming to see me.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was Andrew speaking to The Gatekeepers director, Dror Morey.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
We're going to be speaking about Japanese outsider art in a moment, but to warm us up, a very mainstream cultural product from that country, a song from Kyaru Pyamu Pyamu. This is Candy Candy. That was Candy Candy by J-pop megastar Kyaru Pamu Pamu, who I had on. We had her on the Culture Show, didn't we? She and her retinue came in.
She was with a film crew, wasn't she? A whole posse of people.
Two film crews, the whole deal. I got interviewed by Fuji TV about what it was like to interview Kyaru Pamu Pamu.
That's one of those weird things, isn't it?
It is. It felt very meta. It was a very meta moment in my media career. And right now, you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. In the art world, you often look to the margins of the industry. They're the innovators, the avant-garde, those changing how we define contemporary art and set to shape its future. But head over to the Wellcome Collection here in London and you'll see a different type of fringe art. Sozu displays work by 46 self-taught artists, all of whom are residents or attendees of social welfare institutions across Japan. From kaleidoscopic love letters to sculptures of fruit made from aggregates of ceramic rabbits, Sozu Outside Art from Japan explores issues of language, representation and relationships.
With over 300 works, Sozo is the first major exhibition of Japanese outsider art in the UK, including drawings, paintings and sculpture made by those diagnosed with cognitive and developmental disabilities. In studio now, we have Chief Curator of the Wellcome Collection, James Pito. James, thank you very much for joining us. Could you just explain a little bit, first of all, what we exactly mean by this term, outsider art?
It's a difficult term and much argued about. I actually went to Outsider Art Association, and they spent almost a whole day of the conference arguing about whether they should use the term outsider and what it means. But I suppose it's really come to refer to, when describing artists, people who are almost always self-taught and perhaps live slightly on the margins of society or perceived to live slightly on the margins of society. And I think often there's a suggestion also that this is work that is kind of almost made for its own sake and not necessarily for an audience, but just for the enjoyment of making.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I think it's not surprising to find that a conference on outsider art takes a day to define it. I wonder, before we talk about some of the specific works in the show, whether you feel that a lot of the artists feel that they're artists, whether they are simply making stuff as a means of communicating with the outside world. It's a sort of, it's a habit-forming thing for a lot of these artists that we call outsider artists, right?
It is. I mean, I think, as you mentioned at the beginning, the artists in this particular exhibition are all in the social welfare system in Japan, and some of them don't have access to the materials that they use all the time. But the organisation that we've worked with in Japan to bring the artworks over here is very keen to kind of promote art and to make these facilities available to the people in the institutions. And one of the reasons that they were so happy that we took the show was to really kind of get this stuff out into the world and get people to see how good it is and how much fantastic skill and creativity goes into it.
Now, much of the outside of art we've seen before seems to be some kind of reflection of people's kind of mental health. It's kind of slightly therapeutic, it's kind of inward looking, it's about their conditions. But many of the pieces you have here in this exhibition seem to be kind of looking out at the world.
Well, we very much wanted to put the artworks first and get people to talk about that first. And also, I think, yes, one of the things that we did want people to think about in the exhibition was that this art is not necessarily inward-looking. A lot of the artists are reflecting on the culture and upon their surroundings, both sometimes their immediate surroundings in the places that they live, but also the wider culture, movies, posters, transport systems, the internet, comics. It's all there. It's all as it would be for any other artist.
I wanted to know how you source a lot of this stuff, James, because I work with James Brett at the Museum of Everything when he was doing his last show. It was the show that was on at Selfridges, actually, during Freeze a couple of years ago. Yeah. It was interesting going and seeing him choosing the stuff. And he was literally sent lots of stuff by institutions, especially in Amsterdam. And I guess there are sort of hotspots around the world for this. How did you get in touch with the hospitals or the institutions in Japan? How did you decide to do a Japanese as opposed to a Dutch show, for
example? Well, you mentioned the Dutch. This was actually an exhibition that was initially put together by colleagues at the Museum of Psychiatry, which is called Het Dollhaus, which is in Haarlem in the Netherlands. And they made the initial selection of artists, and they established the relationship with Isokai, which is a welfare organisation in Japan. We saw the exhibition. We're fortunate enough to have a much bigger exhibition space and thought we could expand on it and show a lot of the work that they weren't able to show. So our curator then was in touch with Isokai and went out there and met a lot of the artists and added to the selection. But really, the initial connection was made by Het Dollhaus in Haarlem.
And we said there's over 300 works. Are there one or two that particularly jump out for you?
There certainly are. They're perhaps one of the most remarkable, and the ones that visitors often pick up on first of all, is a tabletop that is covered with 300 tiny action figures, which are actually made, they're each about 3 centimetres high, and they're made of rubbish ties, those little bits of metal with paper around that you use to tie your rubbish sacks together. And in Japan, they make these, their rubbish ties are rather more beautiful than ours, and they're very shiny and sort of metallic. Katsube, the artist, makes these tiny little figures very quickly out of these rubbish ties, but they're incredibly intricate. So they have weapons, that some of them are kind of almost like recognizable cartoon figures. And there's a huge tabletop of these things all spread out in front of you. And
it sounds a little bit Jake and Dinas Chapman in his vision.
It is, in a way, but they're actually, he makes them individually. So then there's not necessarily a direct relationship between them, but each one individually is an extraordinary piece of sculpture. And then just some of the drawings are incredibly beautiful. There's an artist called Tsuji who makes kind of still lives, which are almost like kind of Mirandis. They're fantastically skilled works of art. The material that they use is often fantastic and kind of beautifully. Some of the textile works are extraordinary. There's an artist who only makes work using the bits of thread that are left behind in the workshop by the other artists who have gone. So he comes into the studio at the end of the day and all that's there are these tiny little bits of thread. And he makes these fantastic abstract textiles out of all of these different coloured threads. They look rather like kind of Cy Twombly's, but entirely made of textiles. They're fantastic things.
And these sound like the kind of kickoffs that regular artists, contemporary artists, artists represented at galleries sometimes require, a kickoff like this, you know, kind of an idea like using someone else's leftovers to make their art with. There's a huge amount to learn, I guess, from artists that, as we said, maybe do or don't know they're artists, but certainly aren't doing it for a commercial sense. Is there a market for outsider art?
You mentioned James Brett earlier. Yeah. I think there definitely is a market. And actually, I think one of the things that Isekai have done is to try to protect some of the artists from the really strong market forces and allow them to kind of control their own markets a bit. And I think that's been an important intervention. But I think there is one of the things that I particularly enjoyed hearing at the opening of the exhibition was other artists coming and talking about why they responded strongly to particular artworks. And one of the things that people like, I think, is the kind of directness of a lot of the art, the sort of enjoyment of materials and the sense, as you'd hinted at, that there isn't that kind of baggage of the art world and the art market around it. It's one person engaging with great enthusiasm in many cases with the materials that are available. And you sometimes just get that kind of strong sense of directness.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that as a curator, that it must be nice to be working with people that use materials in a very visceral way or a very natural way or very hands-on way, rather than always harking back to a canon, harking back to their learning, their college stuff. For you, was that something you felt when you visited these places and when you opened up some of the loads of works that came into the Welcome Collection?
Sadly, it was my colleague Shamita Sharmacharja who went and visited the artist, so I wish that I'd had that experience, but unfortunately I didn't. But I did have the experience of the, you know, the opening of the crate experience. And yes, I think in a lot of the work there is a kind of fantastic energy. I mean, repetition is a feature of some of the works, and that in itself has its own kind of energy, I think.
Yeah.
And sometimes very kind of direct marks, but with this amazing energy all over the page, kind of really jumps out at you.
And after people have walked around the exhibition, what do you hope they feel as they leave?
I hope that they will think quite a bit about just the nature of making art and what it means to be an artist. I hope they will have thoroughly enjoyed the individual artworks, but I hope they'll also have thought a bit about the term outsider art and is it useful? What does it mean? I hope to engage with a lot of those questions, I hope.
Brilliant.
All right, James, well, thank you so much for coming in. The show is Suzu. I'm getting it right, aren't I?
That's right, you're getting it right.
Yeah, yeah, people will know what I mean, won't they? It's subtitled Outsider Art from Japan, and that runs until the 30th of June 2013 at London's Welcome Collection. Thanks, James.
Thank you.
That was James Petto, Chief Curator at the Wellcome Collection. And that show is organised in association with Het Dollhaus, the Museum of Psychiatry in Haarlem, and the social welfare organisation Isekai in Japan.
After the break, Demos director and author David Goodhart discusses immigration and Britain's working class.
We love to champion retailers who make a point of differentiating themselves from other offerings on the high street. Our latest Monocle briefing film travels to Buenos Aires, New York, and Budapest to visit specialist shops where making is at the heart of their retail offering.
One of the big challenges with any denim brand, or any brand for that matter, is to really try and explain to the customer why it's special, why it's unique, and why it's worth investing, you know, a lot of money in a great product.
You can view handmade retailers and over 300 more films and slideshows on monocle.com.
During times of economic hardship, the issue of immigration can be a contentious one, especially in global cities like London, where an international workforce is integral to creating diversity and driving prosperity.
We're joined in studio by David Goodhart, director of think tank Demos and author of A British Dream, who thinks Britain has got its policy wrong. Fresh from Demos's roundtable on diversity and the white working class earlier this week, we'll mull over how he thinks the UK's immigration stance is responsible for a loss of shared identity in the British working class. David, thank you very much for coming in and joining us. The topic that you are beginning to tackle both in your book, The British Dream, and in the conference you had with Demos yesterday, it seems to have upset a large number of people. There seem to be lots of theories flying around why you've entered this debate and whether you're a post-liberal, you know, liberal, an anti-liberal. Before we kind of get into what the critics are saying, could you just summarise us for us in a way that a global audience can understand what you think is at the heart of the problem of immigration in the UK?
I think the short-term problem has simply been the level of immigration. I mean, since 1997, it has been far too high for most people in Britain. And that is, you know, we're a democracy, that's a very big factor. The faster it happens and the higher the levels, the harder it is also to absorb people, to integrate people into an already existing society. That is a particular problem. I see it as somebody with sort of leftish sympathies from the point of view of sustaining the relatively high degree of sharing and cooperation required in a modern welfare society. And I don't think we'll be able to sustain the kind of level of sharing implied in the modern welfare state for many more decades. If we have such high levels of people coming into the society who are not properly absorbed and whom the existing population can't sort of see as part of their imagined community.
When you talk about that, are you talking about immigration at every level of society? Are you saying we can't absorb the French bankers and we can't absorb the German doctors? Or are you just saying that actually it's more on the kind of the level of the unskilled labourers who have come here? That's the level you can't absorb people.
Yeah, obviously, I mean, you know, immigration covers a huge number of different categories of people, and we clearly can absorb the French bankers and the German doctors, and it's much more problematic with the poorly educated or completely uneducated people from poor countries. We have 150,000, is it 200,000 Somalis living in Britain, very few of whom work. They're sort of here by accident. I mean, actually, a lot of post-war immigration, as I discovered when I looked into it for the book I've written, happened by accident. I mean, right from the beginning in 1948, when we introduced a Nationality Act, which opened the door to 600 million people from the Empire and Commonwealth. And we've sort of continued to have these sort of accidents. Yeah, they haven't all been terrible accidents. Some of them have been very fortuitous. I mean, I'm not saying that all immigration is terrible. What I'm arguing is that we should return to the more moderate levels of immigration that we had in the 80s or 90s, say, that people are perfectly comfortable with that. We're a very open society and we should continue to be. Indeed, the challenge for us is how we now remain an open society, have the degrees of interchange and flow across our borders that is required by a modern sophisticated society. We particularly have require that for the financial centre that we are, for the higher education that we also specialise in. These require large numbers of people to come into the country, most of whom then flow out again. For that to work and for people to have confidence in it, we need an efficient immigration bureaucracy, which we have not really had. I mean, the government are now focusing on that a lot more. belatedly, but I think that is beginning to be set right.
Butt in then and talk about you were going to make a case for a more of an economic argument about immigration, possibly. And we obviously are in straitened times. Is it ever possible to talk about immigration purely in terms of numbers, of balancing books, of welfare versus income, and all this pretty straight-laced, straight down the line stuff? Is it ever possible to have a debate about immigration just on those terms without bringing in the more emotional side of it?
Well, I don't think you should. I mean, I think you should bring in the emotional side. I mean, you know, we live in a democracy. People feel emotional when their neighbourhoods are suddenly changed and nobody has asked them and all of that. I mean, these are perfectly legitimate things to talk about as well. I mean, yeah, there's an economic dimension to it and there's a sort of cultural dimension to it. And I think the argument that you often hear from supporters of large-scale immigration is that there's a huge economic benefit. Yes, it does have unfortunate and sometimes negative side effects for people in certain communities, and we've somehow got to mitigate that in order to enjoy the great economic benefits. I challenge that in that I don't think the economic benefits are there. I mean, if you read the literature as I've done, immigration is broadly neutral on all the things that matter and somewhat negative for people in the lower half of the income spectrum. So there isn't a huge economic benefit that we have to suffer all these other things in order to enjoy. As I say, that's not to say we shouldn't have any immigration, but it should be, you know, and I think the government's goal actually of tens of thousands, net immigration of tens of thousands, which would still mean an annual inflow of 200 plus thousand people a year. I mean, this is still historically unprecedentedly high, even with the tens of thousands goal achieved. So I think we just need to return to some common sense.
I wonder how you would ideally see the debate playing out, David, in terms of balancing the economic and the emotional side of it. Because it's a tough one to even... It's a great divider in boardrooms and in pubs up and down the country and across the world, isn't it? And I wonder how it's possible to set the tone of that debate.
Yeah, I mean... Large-scale immigration is never popular anywhere, in any country, at any time. But people, because most people prioritise the people and the things close to them and the familiar, that's part of human nature to do that. That doesn't mean to say, you know, if it's properly handled and the numbers aren't too great and people make an effort to join in who are coming from other places, then they become absorbed and they become part of the tribe, as it were, and that can work perfectly well, as it has done. We had a lot of conflict when we had the first wave of the post-colonial immigration to Britain in the 50s and 60s, but it settled down. They have, in most cases, become comfortable parts of Britain and regarded as such by their fellow British citizens.
But isn't that just a time lag? You look at British people abroad and they're actually rather rubbish at integrating themselves into society. You go to Spain, supposedly a million British people living along the coast, and they certainly go out of their way to make sure that they don't learn Spanish, that they don't eat Spanish food, they don't visit Spanish towns. That's just a time lag, isn't it? Because it will be their children who go there and live there and finally go to schools there who will learn Spanish. You can't quite expect the first wave of immigrants to be completely absorbed into the society and to understand all of its nuances. It takes a generation.
No, I agree. It takes time. And that's why we need to keep the numbers down in a way, because societies have absorptive capacities. But it's a bit of a myth what you were saying about Spain. There aren't anything like that number of British people in Spain. I think it's closer to 500,000, of whom about 150,000 are retirees. I mean, we often think of the...
But they're certainly not retirees in a Spanish sense. Most of them don't speak Spanish. And they don't make any effort to learn Spanish.
That is true of many of them. There are about 5 million British citizens who live abroad. The vast majority of them live, not surprisingly, in Anglophone countries, America, Australia, Ireland, South Africa. Most of them work there for a few years and then come back to Britain. Some of them stay for longer than that. Spain is a slightly exceptional example, but the numbers aren't that high. I mean, I think the people should.
But isn't that
if they're living somewhere,
when you're talking about those immigration numbers, surely that's the case for a huge number of the Polish people, for example, who came here. They earned money, they learnt skills, they took what they needed, and they kind of left. They went back. They didn't want to stay here. They actually found that there were just as many jobs back in Poland. So you see a kind of a revolving door. It's not that all these people come and they never leave.
Well, the Polish situation is different again. Obviously, that's to do with the European Union openness, which people simply don't understand, and I have some sympathy with them. We have to treat all 500 million members of the European Union, whatever our historic ties to them or non-existent historic ties to them, as if they are British citizens in all the things that matter, like the labour market, like welfare, like housing lists. And people just do not think that that is appropriate. And I think they're right in a way. And we got the cart before the horse here. I mean, it was never intended. In 1957, when the Treaty of Rome was drawn up and free movement of labour was included in it, no one assumed that a great body of countries with 80 million people in them, with one quarter or one fifth the average standard of living, would join the European Union. But we haven't been able to kind of unravel it. And Britain has been affected more than any other country in Europe on this. And I don't think it's been a success story. 20% of low-skilled jobs in Britain are taken by people born outside the country. I mean, we're Saudi Arabianizing our country in a way. We're dumping a whole lot of people on welfare who are not attractive to employ. And we're taking, some of the sort of, brightest and most energetic people from Latvia and Poland.
But if you strip away that generation of people who are the brightest and you leave them, employers and the people who have to kind of harvest vegetables and, run factories with a kind of a work-shy generation of British people, is that a solution?
No, it's not. I mean, I think it's an absolute disastrous solution. I mean, we have a social contract. We have obligations to the less successful people in our own society. And we're turning our back on that obligation. We're saying, we'll have those rather more successful people from that country, please, because they will work harder and they'll turn up. Of course they do. They're good. I have nothing against them. And if I was an employer, I'd employ them too before the local hoodie with two GCSEs and a whole lot of attitude. I mean, it's completely understandable that people do that. But we shouldn't have set up the structure like that in the first place. I mean, we need to get that hoodie into a proper job and turn him into a decent, hardworking person. And that, takes a lot of time and effort. And we've abandoned them.
Can I ask about that? Because that was not the subtitle of your book, that's Successes and Failures of Post-War Immigration, but this the Demos Roundtable this week was Diversity in the White Working Class, David. How do you fix a problem like the white working class? And I wonder if the rest of Europe certainly has problems with its working classes in a similar sense.
Well, I'm not sure they are a problem, really. I mean, there are... it depends who you describe.
Well, maybe I'm referring to the hoodie with two GCSEs. Yeah.
All societies have less successful people in them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there is a particular phenomenon in this society at this time that we have told...
Is it fair to say, for example, also that lots of people, when they think of the white working class, think of people that are white but don't work, don't have any
money? Have told a whole generation, for almost a generation, we have said to people that basic low-skilled jobs, the kind of jobs that Latvians and Poles come in and do very happily, are for failures and for foreigners. Mm. We have talked about nothing else but aspiration. We have said we must send 50% of the cohort to university. What kind of signal do you think that sends to the less successful people? And it is well known. I mean, we've never been as good at the whole vocational side of things as the Germans and the Austrians and people like that, and we've abandoned the people in the bottom third of our society, and better off Brits have enjoyed the benefits of the labour that has flowed in to service them or work for them from other European countries, and that's not a proper way to run a decent country, I don't think.
Before we go, then, we should try and fix this. We've got to do it quite briefly, unfortunately. But what is your fix? Is it kicking off with a debate about this, about immigration? Or what would you do if you were in power to affect this?
I think it's very hard to say that we don't talk about these things any longer, but we do. We talk about we talk about little else.
Yeah.
And I think we have a much more open and healthy debate about it. Although, we've had three huge political speeches in the last fortnight or so, all of which have been incredibly dull and technical, because actually they can't talk about the things that we were just talking about earlier, that actually... it's ludicrous, or it completely conflicts with most people's sort of common sense idea of fellow citizen favouritism, of what it is to be a citizen of a country. We've completely undermined that with our EU openness policy. I mean, this is something we've inherited. It's no one's fault exactly, but I think what we should do is partly what the government is doing on bringing the numbers down to more sensible levels. I think we need to worry more about integration. We need to worry about the bottom end of the white working class too, and that becomes a lot easier you know, if employers are desperate for their labour, we need to pay people more at the bottom of the pile too. I mean, we have a minimum wage, but it's far too low, I think. You know, if people were seeing they could get a decent, you know, £8 or £10 an hour for doing a basic job, then I think, you know, there are far fewer people selling drugs on the street corner.
Then where would we be? So we had to end it on a happy note. David Goodhart, thank you very much for joining us. The book is The British Dream: Successes and Failures of Post-War Immigration. Thank you very much. And that was author and Demos director David Goodhart helping us pick our way, Andrew, through the thorny subject of immigration. Did you get any prickles on you? Did you get any burrs stuck in your jumper?
Slightly. I shall refrain.
All right. That's what we've got time for, isn't it?
It is.
What are we going to do now?
Write
something for the book.
Write a book about doing that.
I wish we were still talking about immigration.
But I am packing my bags. I'm going to Madrid this week. So
I
head
off
on Wednesday. So I'll be there with Liam Adams, and we're doing 2 days of programmes live.
Oh, nice.
And he's already booked a late lunch on Friday. So I'm not coming home.
That's okay. The San Miguel will flow, or the Rioja, or something similar, right?
All of it.
All of it, Rob. All of it. Nice. I liked today's show. It had a serious note.
Yes.
We shouldn't be scared of that, should we? Just because it's a Sunday, Andrew.
No, and I really do think anybody who can get to see The Gatekeepers, you should go and see it. It's a really extraordinary film. And I think, you know, that's the amazing thing, that over the last year, the number of really great documentaries we've had and filmmakers who are just really telling extraordinary stories. So it is really, really worth seeing.
Cool, and we can return that favour to all of our guests, I suppose, and what they've brought in under their arms. We didn't get any outsider art actually in the studio.
No,
but we should go and see that.
Well, it's only across the park, so we would be a bit lazy if we didn't.
It's a bit too near.
Yeah.
That is it for edition 196 of The Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by David Michon and Tom Hall, and our researcher was Josh Fennett. Our studio manager, Ananima Nema Nema. He's no kind of anemone. He can be prickly, but he's no anemone of mine, is Jack Phillips. We'll be back same time, same place next week. But until then, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Goodbye, and thanks for tuning in.